Hello, and welcome to another episode of Anesthesia Campus. My name's Lucy Guile, and I'm a registrar in anaesthetics, currently working in Glasgow. Today's guest is also an anaesthetic registrar, currently completing a PhD at the University of Cambridge on the subject of systems thinking in global health. He has spent time working with VSO in Ethiopia, for which he was awarded the AAGBI NPS Patient Safety Prize, and has a number of teaching and advisory roles in the field of global health, including teaching on the King's College London MSc in Global Health with Surgery and Anesthesia. He contributed to the recently released Oxford Specialist Handbook of Global Anesthesia and is the outgoing president of the World Anesthesia Society. Most of his recent work has been based in Yangon, Myanmar, through Cambridge Global Health Partnerships and the NIHR Global Health Research Group on Neurotrauma. Tom Bashford, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks very much for having me.
Hi, Tom. Thanks very much for joining us today. It's great to see you. So as we've just heard, you've got a lot of experience in the field of global health, but medicine wasn't your first degree. What was it that prompted you to change direction, and was the possibility of working abroad part of the draw for you?
Indirectly, I think. So I started off as a biochemist and did a master's and then worked for the Royal Society for a year. And probably about two thirds of the way through my undergraduate course, I realized that I was not going to be a biochemist and that I wanted to do something a bit more practical and a bit more applied. And medicine had kind of been bubbling around in my head for a little while. As an undergraduate, yes, I liked travel and I liked visiting places overseas. And I had a sort of a vague sense that medicine was a transferable qualification which could allow me to go and live and work in other places. But there was no fully formed idea of getting into global health before starting medicine, I'd have said. That all came probably toward the end of my medical degree, and then going into foundation training is when it sort of started to take shape in earnest.
And was there anything specific that that encouraged you to get involved with this kind of thing, or was it really just an interest that seemed to grow out of nowhere in particular?
No, I think it's, I think these decisions are always kind of complex. One of my very good friends works for the Department for International Development. My other half works for UNICEF. And so I was surrounded by this bubble of development, global health, as I was sort of studying medicine and qualifying. And then I guess a series of conversations led me to think, actually, I'd like to go away and work somewhere else and see how these things are done, you know, how medicine's done differently elsewhere. And so that took me to Ethiopia with VSO. And I went as a really comparatively very junior anaesthetist in 2011 to 2012. And I think that probably started off with the idea that I'd go for a year and see how it was. And that was then the catalyst. So going to Ethiopia was the sort of the game changer. And from that point on, I kind of came back with global health as my, I guess, as my thing. But of course, you know, as I guess a lot of the people listening to this will have realized by now, global health isn't always a thing, especially global anesthesia. You know, there's no career track as such. There's no clear path through. It's an interest which you find ways to indulge, but it's challenging, and you're constantly, I think, gently critiqued for it by your colleagues and peers who don't have an interest in global health, because it doesn't count as a subspecialty interest. It doesn't count as a, you know, it's not a thing that people do that much, or certainly historically have done that much. It's quite a small community. I think that's probably changing. I'd say in terms of the, if you like, the academic and anesthetic structures, that's changing massively. But certainly coming back from Ethiopia at sort of the end of 2012, there was not a lot of really obvious opportunity for kind of a global health career as it's such. And I don't know, a couple of people have asked me about global health as a career, and I'd say I don't have a career. I have a series of events which have happened to me, which when you look at them in hindsight, look like they were thought through, but mostly they've just happened as one decision after another.
So one of the reasons that I particularly wanted to talk to you was because you've managed to integrate global health, particularly given that it's not really a recognised subspecialty, or, you know, it's not a thing in its own right that you can just easily go and do necessarily. You've actually incorporated it remarkably well into your career, haven't you? And I think that's largely through the academic side of things. So I wonder if you could talk a bit more about how you've done that, and what you've done sort of academically that's involved global health.
Sure. So I was never going to be an academic doctor. Like, I left university, left medical school, had done well at medical school, but had no real interest in clinical research. I didn't think, you know, I wanted to be a practical, good doctor. And then in Ethiopia, published a couple of things just because I started to look at sort of what I could do as a volunteer and found a massive kind of black hole where an evidence base might be for how anaesthetists should do global health. And specifically in Ethiopia at that point, no one was publishing anything on anaesthesia from Ethiopia. And there were lots of kind of questions bubbling up about, you know, from the clinical to kind of like, you know, use of regional anaesthesia and what you do about that with non-physician anaesthetists, through to the more structural and task sharing and task shifting and how you develop an anaesthetic service if you have a non-physician anaesthesia cadre, how you develop those people, what that means for things like intensive care or critical care provision, how you develop subspecialty training if you have non-physician anaesthetists as your predominant workforce, and people solving that in different ways, either through MSc programs or doctoral programs or anaesthesiologists or, you know, any one of the ways that those problems are solved. And so I started asking myself these questions, and publishing sort of a couple of very small, mostly kind of quality improvement type papers. And then that sort of developed into this academic interest. And really, I think I started out doing it to give some structure to my time in Ethiopia, because it was something I felt I could do. And clinically, I was reasonably undercooked and I didn't feel I could offer that much, but the kind of the more academic stuff I could help with. And then I came back to the UK and I realized there were these academic clinical fellowships for my kind of registrar training that were available. And that, being brutally honest, what I saw that as is that was protected time, which could be given to global health. And as long as I dressed it up in a suitably academic way, somebody might give me this time away from clinical training to devote to global health, which is what I was now interested in. And I was really lucky. You know, I applied for a couple of clinical fellowships, and although my CV was pretty strong, what I wanted to do really didn't fit with a couple of places. But Cambridge, and particularly David Menon, who's the professor of anaesthesia here, were very accommodating to this slightly rogue applicant who said, look, I want to do this thing that's not really a thing, but give me a place and I'll make it work. And they did. And so then I spent 3 years in Cambridge kind of desperately trying to work out what it was I was interested in and what the academic home for that was. And what that became, or rather what became more clear, was that what I was interested in was exactly how we solve these kind of quite complex interconnected problems. So, you know, improving global health from a kind of perioperative care point of view is so rarely about a discrete training course, a discrete technological intervention. It's not about a drug. It's not about a technique. It's about a really complicated interdependent series of processes, which you need to look at holistically. So if you train loads of non-physician anaesthetists to provide immediate service, what do you then plan for in terms of what they're trained to do, what they're trained to use, how autonomous they're trained to be? Are they allowed to subspecialize? What's their career progression? And what I realized I was interested in is trying to look at problems holistically within the context of global health and global anaesthesia. And then that led me to the healthcare design team in Cambridge, which are a bunch of systems engineers and systems designers who are interested in healthcare, and they're particularly interested in complex problems. And so that then developed into a kind of an academic home for me. And I spent a year trying to put together a PhD proposal, which would allow me to indulge this new academic interest in systems and systems thinking and ally it to global anaesthesia. And then anyone who's sort of tried to put together a PhD project on their own will know how this goes, that you kind of ping pong around these ideas. And, you know, at one point it was about, I was going to go to Uganda and look at anaesthetic training. And then at other points I was going to go somewhere else and do something else. And in that time, I'd got really involved with one of the institutional partnerships run through Cambridge University Hospitals, which was based in Myanmar in Yangon General Hospital. And we'd had FET funding through the Health Partnership Scheme to set up a partnership which was focused on trauma. And that was really well thought through and well put together. So we were looking at trauma from a really interesting systems holistic angle. We were looking at nursing and physiotherapy, pathology, anesthesia and ICU, orthopedic surgery. We made all this lovely kind of reasonably tight network with these semi-autonomous arms for different clinical specialities, but all geared around improving trauma care. And then what happened was that the NIHR released a load of global health research money, and one of our neurosurgeons, Peter Hutchinson, decided that he would apply for a global health research group, and his big interest is in traumatic brain injury. And so suddenly that gave us this platform to say, okay, well, let's look at specifically the brain injury aspect of trauma, and we'll base it in Myanmar because we have friends and a partnership and a lot of kind of cultural and institutional understanding there. And so all of a sudden that systems interest had a, if you like, a home, which was based in the colleagues and friends in Myanmar that I already had. But it was bounded by this idea, okay, we'll look at neurotrauma specifically, and we'll look at the systems around neurotrauma care. And suddenly this takes a kind of very airy-fairy nebulous idea and gives you something tractable and something describable. And so my PhD research essentially bifurcated that one aspect of it looks at the care of the brain injured patient in Myanmar and how that can be understood holistically and then modelled and then improved. And the other arm of the work became looking actually at this idea of systems thinking and how well that fits the current global health practice. And so that became very involved in going and talking to academics, medical students going overseas for the first time, and people who sort of see themselves as global health practitioners, either as funding bodies or charities or people running health partnerships, and trying to work out whether these ideas of holism, of systems, of seeing problems in the round as opposed to very discrete reductive problems that you solve piece by piece, whether that fit with the kind of the emergent experience of global health practitioners. And so interestingly, I'm now in the place where my thesis is all about systems thinking in global health, but the papers and the research work that we're publishing and acting on are all about brain injury in Myanmar. And so that's how it's all kind of evolved and taken shape. And I'm now at the end of the PhD and coming back into clinical training with the hope that there's a clinical lectureship available to let me kind of then build the next bit. And so now into this kind of academic merry-go-round of bidding for more money to do more stuff, you know, filling in grant application forms. And with that comes the challenge of thinking up new research questions that predominantly are useful and will do good in the place where you situate them, and then secondarily are academically interesting and kind of worth asking from an academic standpoint. And I think the big challenge of global health, and I guess we're seeing it a lot in kind of COVID academia now, is that the impact has to be the major driver. So you've got to be looking at what change will this make in the world rather than what's my little stone on the academic cairn of knowledge. But you can't ignore the latter. You know, it's got to be a question worth asking as well as, you know, a useful thing worth doing.
So can you give us a little bit of context about Myanmar itself and sort of healthcare there? Because it's a country that I've heard of, but that I know nothing about. And I don't know anyone that's visited there. It'd be great to just hear a little bit about what healthcare and perhaps trauma care, what's the baseline state of play? What's it like there in Myanmar?
Wow. Yes, I mean, I feel woefully under-equipped. You know, there are so many people that could answer this question better than me, but I'm very happy to tell you what I know and what I've seen. So Myanmar, I mean, it's a fascinating place, and I could monologue for hours about the background of the country and kind of charting its socio-political history. I guess in a nutshell, it is a country in Southeast Asia that was subject to British colonial rule, but has now been independent for a long time, has, you know, an incredibly rich, brilliant cultural past. Within its citizens places an enormous pedigree an enormous weight on education. So despite having a very low GDP, it has phenomenally high literacy rates, and education, and particularly medicine, is held in very high regard. And it's a country which is rapidly emerging in terms of an economy. It's got enormous natural resources, and as it stabilizes out politically, there's a huge rush to use those to drive an economy. And obviously it comes with all of the challenges of how you manage interested overseas agents who are interested in those natural resources, and the interests of the local populace and the local government to make that sustainable and make that work for their people in the long term. And healthcare wise, there's a lot that's very familiar to the UK clinician, because a great number of those structures kind of have a post-colonial feel. So, you know, medical training looks very familiar. Post graduation medical training looks very familiar. People go through an internship, which looks a lot like a foundation program, and then they do junior jobs, which looks a lot like being an SHO, and then they do long specialist training of kind of, you know, 5 years plus, which looks a lot like being a registrar. A subsection of their medical workforce then go and do higher research degrees as part of their subspecialty training. And so you have a very highly educated medical workforce that is then challenged by the material deficit in the healthcare system. So, you know, they struggle, and GDP fund, you know, as in funding as a proportion of GDP has risen under the current government, and there's been a big push by the country to increase the levels of funding. So they're increasing relatively, but they're still absolutely comparatively low just because of the poverty of the country. But they're rapidly escalating, and there's big ambitions to improve healthcare. A bit like the UK, healthcare services are massively concentrated in the major cities, and Yangon is the dominant kind of economic city. It's the kind of economic and cultural capital, although the political capital is in Naypyidaw, which is further north. And if you look at the area I know, which is Yangon particularly, and my knowledge and understanding of what happens in the other states and in the rural provinces is limited. But a bit like the London teaching hospitals, there are one or two really big hospitals in Yangon that dominate the medical ecosystem. They have very dense referral flight paths in, so lots of people come from outside the capital to go to those centres. And a lot of the medics want to work in Yangon. And so it's sort of very high density, both of public practice and of private practice. And because it's where the money is, that's where you have the private hospitals. There isn't at the moment a kind of integrated trauma network. So there's no really obvious referral or repatriation system. If you're injured up country, it's up to you generally to get yourself to Yangon, or there's a complex arrangement of private transport and ambulances and what have you. And then once within Yangon, again, there's not a citywide trauma network. So if you're hit by a car in Yangon, you might be able to tell people where you want to be taken, or you might go to the nearest place, or you might go to sort of the place that your family choose to take you. And then within the hospitals, they are rapidly trying to improve how they manage trauma. There's been a big push in recent years to develop emergency medicine as an independent cadre and to train them well. And I think it's probably fair to say at the moment that if you have single organ trauma or relatively uncomplicated trauma, then there is sort of a pathway and people know where you should go. You go into ED, you get stabilized, and they call the relevant specialty team and they come and look after you. The complexity for them at the moment is in polytrauma. And I think, I don't know if that's a function of resource poverty, or it's probably more likely to be resource poverty overlaid on existing cultural hierarchical communication norms, that it's very hard to get really complex multidisciplinary teams to manage trauma. So all the right people with all the right brains are in the hospital, but managing to get them to come together and function as an MDT or as a trauma team is really hard. And that's exacerbated by the physical infrastructure of the hospital. So for example, the neurosurgical service is over the road from the main hospital. So if you have orthopedic trauma and neurotrauma, you can't be in the right place for both because they're physically distant. And then there are difficulties of making those two departments work alongside each other. As I say, I'm always really taken by the level of training and insight and intelligence of the Burmese doctors. You know, they are almost universally really smart, really well-educated people. What they have not had exposure to in the main is what a completely tight-knit functioning healthcare system feels like. And so it's a bit like, if you imagine, you know, one of the analogies I use for people is, if you imagine what it's like when you leave medical school and you go onto the wards for the first time as a foundation year one, you've got all this theoretical knowledge about how to do stuff. But if someone puts a drug chart in your hands and says, prescribe a sliding scale, you think, I really don't know what to write in these boxes. And then what you do is you find the SHO who says, oh, we do it like this. Or there's a sticker in that drawer and you stick it on the back and you fill it in. And so you gradually become encultured to a way of working that knits together. And I think for some Burmese medics, what you see is that apprenticeship has not always been tight because the health service has been fragmented. And so while there's a really strong academic understanding of what should be delivered, it can be maddening for them. They really struggle to make that happen. And there's a load of other reasons for that as well. You know, there's a great dearth of nurses. They're probably trained at a lower numerical proportion to that number of doctors produced. So if you imagine the way we're skewed is that we necessarily have far more nurses trained than we have doctors, because that's the way our pyramid works in terms of healthcare provision. And in Myanmar, because medicine's such a prestigious degree, there's far more doctors than there are nurses. And that changes everything about how you can care for patients and sort of how healthcare is delivered. The hospitals themselves are amazing. They have these huge rambling ex-colonial structures with kind of like birds of paradise flitting through the windows and rotating ceiling fans and marble floors. And then parachuted on next to them will be much more modern blocks. So, you know, in Yangon general, the theatre block is very modern, but it'll be right next door to the kind of rambling, kind of beautiful, but slightly dilapidated, you know, brick building next to it. And there's lots of work going on to try to retrofit the older buildings to make them a bit more fit for purpose. But it's a hodgepodge of old, new, was new, now aging buildings and kind of infrastructure. And it's interesting, I think, coming from somewhere like Ethiopia, one of the things I found interesting is that there are commonalities to me, and not just looking at these two countries, but other places I've either been exposed to, visited, or spoken to other people about, that there are commonalities, I think, of resource poverty that you see in healthcare delivery. But there are also massive nuances that are completely different country to country, which is why, you know, sometimes I think the whole concept of global health is wrong, that, you know, some things are generalizable, but some things are absolutely context specific. And the idea that we come up with solutions for low and middle income countries as a massive block strikes me as not always the right way to think about things. You know, there are solutions that will work well in Myanmar that would never work in Ethiopia and vice versa. And so how you do the right thing in the right place, as opposed to deciding that you have the right thing and working out how to do it.
And with your PhD research, is there an element of it which is looking at how we make these decisions and make sure that they are relevant to specific contexts? Because I know that your PhD research has been very collaborative, in that you've made sure that it's involving clinicians in Burma and has used their expertise rather than parachuting in and telling them that this is how we feel from Cambridge that things ought to be done in their generic lower middle income country.
Yeah, I think that's a huge issue. And I guess the more I speak to people who've done global health for a long time, the more I realize that there are certain common elements for a certain tribe within that community, which is people who've lived or worked somewhere for a prolonged period of time and been challenged in the post-colonial mindset with which, if we're not careful, we're all gently indoctrinated. So if I think, you know, I grew up as a kid in the 80s and my vision of Ethiopia was famine and Live Aid and kids with flies in their eyes. And it is still true that when I get a taxi back from the airport from Burma, the taxi driver says, oh, is there anything in Myanmar? I just thought it was like, you know, temples and jungle. Like, do you live in a hut while you're there? And you think, no, I live in a hotel. It's a big functioning, massive capital city where everyone has got smartphones. And so there is a huge kind of process of learning, which you have to be open to, which also challenges that everything that you thought was probably wrong. So the very idea of rich white people going to countries to help comes with a challenge and comes with a power imbalance and comes with a whole load of assumed and imposed cultural norms and expectations and assumptions, which you just have to keep looking at and smashing down and chipping away at and questioning. So I think in research, we're learning that, you know, we're learning that research within resource poor countries has to be led by researchers in resource poor countries. That takes a degree of research capacity building. And at the moment, there is not the money or the expertise in the system. And so that is something which we from outside can offer, because ultimately we have a rich system which has trained lots of people to be researchers. So one genuine good we can do is to go out and share those expertise. What we must absolutely not do is use that imbalance to then drive a research agenda which suits us, or that, you know, is, you know, serves either our pet interest or is to our own advancement, because what you're trying to do is build that capacity as a moral good in the country that you're visiting. And so, yeah, we've tried really hard to do that in the work in Myanmar. And I've no doubt that a really clear-sighted external observer of that would challenge us on lots of things which we've missed. But I think sometimes you've just got to pitch in with the best possible motives and the best way you can conceive it and then accept that you're going to get it wrong and challenge yourself along the way. And so I think what's hard, I think, now is that you have people within the global health community who are quite a long way along that journey. But you have people getting involved for really good reasons with excellent motivation who have not yet been through that process. And I think there's a really difficult conversation where new colleagues are becoming interested in global health, but you have to start the process of gently smashing out of them all the things that they think, either subconsciously or consciously, about what that engagement means and what their role in it is going to be. And I think probably quite a few of us who got into global health from a clinical perspective have watched that happening from an academic perspective as the global health research money has become available, either through the NIHR or through the Global Challenges Research Fund. There's been loads of academics who have suddenly got interested in global health, but have not been through that learning process of kind of humility and deconstructing all of their own biases. And I think, you know, we are hopefully constantly being challenged in a good way about the implicit gender bias that we have in the UK and implicit racial bias that we have in the UK, and the fact that those things still go on and people are still discriminated against because of the colour of their skin or because of their gender or their perceived gender. And all of those invisible biases are still present in all of our global health work and just need to be called out and challenged and, you know, critiqued and looked at honestly and openly and sympathetically and then hopefully made better. So I find that aspect of it really interesting. I think with research at the moment, it is a constant battle to honestly assess whether the research you're doing is the right research to be doing and is being done in the right way. And hopefully what you do is just each project gets a bit better and a bit better and a bit better. And I've no doubt I'll look back in 10 years at what we're doing now and be horrified. But hopefully that means we've got to a better place by that point.
I think this is slightly off topic, but certainly for lots of medical students, their first exposure and sometimes their only exposure to the field of global health is in their electives. I wonder if I think the answer is probably no, we could do more in terms of medical schools with regard to preparing people for going and doing either clinical or research work abroad. I think that there was no specific question associated with that, but it sort of leads on quite neatly from what you say about whether we're going with the right set of assumptions to a place and whether we're thinking hard about whether the clinical or research work that we do is to the benefit of the people that we're going to work with, or whether it's primarily to our own benefit.
Absolutely. And I think I've been really privileged to be involved in some of the global health work that's going on with the clinical school in Cambridge. And through that, I've seen some of the work that's going on a more national level through both student societies and within clinical schools themselves to improve the global health education for medical students. I think you're right. For a long time, people's expectations were sort of set by electives, and electives were very post-colonial, that people kind of went off to poor countries and, you know, everyone came back and showed their scars and said, oh yeah, I did my first appendectomy in a, you know, village hospital in Nicaragua. And you think you were absolutely not meant to be doing that. But there was a whole generation of people for whom that was almost what you did on elective. And I think we are quite rapidly disassembling those quite harmful models. And I hope providing students with a better grounding in global health. But I think actually, you know, it goes into a wider point, and this taps back to the kind of the systems focus of what I'm interested in, is that you hear it said a lot, I think, in medical school and then in medicine, that there's a science and an art to medicine. And I think we get very, very well taught about the science, and the art is so often just left to take care of itself, either through experience or the kind of the apprenticeship or through vague mentorship systems in our postgraduate training. And I think we can do better than that. And I think what I see is lots of the problems in global health come from that very reductive mindset that science teaches you, which is that you disaggregate things into reductive questions, you solve them, and if you then just do that, things will get better. And I think there's obviously an enormous role for science, as coming as someone who was a, you know, biochemist, you know, my master's in molecular and cellular biochemistry. Science has revolutionized what we do and what we can do, and must never be ignored. But I think too often that holistic element of how does all this knit together to actually deliver care? How much does that scientific rationale actually pull through to the ward and the clinical interaction? And what are the other things going on that dictate how I deliver care. And actually, there's a whole load of good thinking about how that can be interrogated. It doesn't have to be science. You know, it's, if you like, it's good social science. It's qualitatively appraising what are the drivers in this clinical interaction? What are the systems that are making me behave in a certain way or making me lean towards one decision and not another? And I think that I see being an important part of the medical education curriculum that would massively change how people view global health. So instead of it being just a case of, well, if they just did what we did, they'd have better healthcare. That's not true. If we know the underlying science, we can improve healthcare in these complex scenarios. That's not true. We need a paradigm of thinking of these inputs are very important, but I need to consider that in a very complex system. And I think that is as pertinent to delivering healthcare in the UK as it is to delivering healthcare in the global South. But I think if you start to educate people like that, it will go a huge way to breaking down a lot of those, to me, at best, not as useful as they could be, and at worst, downright harmful global health interventions where people think that just by simply doing a particular thing, implementing a particular process, will suddenly improve care. And that by the implicit assumption, the rich visitor knows that thing that should be being done, and those poor people who are there doing what they're doing at the moment don't understand it. Because actually, my experience is that the guys delivering care in the lower middle income countries know all of the stuff from the high income countries. They've read all of the papers. They know exactly all of the evidence. You know, the people who've quoted the best underlying science for anaesthesia at me were probably the non-physician anaesthetists in Ethiopia. And the people who've been some of the best clinicians by the guidelines have been some of the Ugandan anaesthetists, you know, anaesthesiologists I've spoken to. And they know exactly what the textbook says. They just have a better appreciation that it's not deliverable or not appropriate in the place where they work. And so, yeah, a clever rich person turning up to run a training course in that thing that they know is no good is still no good.
So I'm going to go back for a moment just to talk a little bit more about academic training. For someone who's a bit earlier on in their career than you, or who's maybe doing their SHO or core training years in anaesthetics and is thinking about whether or not trying to apply for an academic training job would be the right thing for them. Are there any disadvantages to academic training that you've found?
Yes, I think if you go the whole hog and you decide to do an MD or a PhD or some kind of program for the study, obviously it delays things, and getting out of sync clinically is hard. And also for a lot of people who go into research, they keep a clinical foot in the water. So, you know, maybe they're, if I look at the guys who work here in the kind of our brain injury group, you know, they might be taking patients to and from MRI scans. You know, they're actually in scrubs for a lot of their research time because it's quite tightly integrated to the clinical care in the institution they're working in. And in global health, that's often not true. So you need to find ways to keep yourself skilled and integrated with like your day-to-day job as a clinician. And so that's a challenge. There are a whole subset of particular challenges in doing academic research in global health, as you might imagine, things like just coming up with projects, getting partners, making sure things are ethically watertight, getting programs running, getting good quality data. You know, all the nuts and bolts of academia are harder in an international collaboration because, you know, it's kind of every problem you can think of is magnified and you've got at least two institutions trying to look at the same thing. In terms of your training, that all sucks time away from you. So even setting up a relatively simple project can be the same amount of work as setting up some really fantastically complex project at home. And managing the various teams becomes a massive part of it because you're doing it at distance, often through a language and cultural barrier. And I think the other hard thing is that it's still a pretty niche place to be. And you have to have a certain amount of stubbornness to make it work because you'll be told it's too hard or too difficult or not real academia or not real science a lot of times. And you have to have a reasonably stubborn independent streak that says, I'm just going to make this work somehow. I'm going to find someone who's going to let me do a PhD with them. I'm going to find some money. I'm going to make this work. And so I think you have to be of that mindset anyway. There's no, at the moment, there's not a nice kind of program or process that you get in the bottom rung of the ladder and people will just help you get to the next stage. So there's still a fair degree of self-starting, I think, for those kind of people. But that being said, I think the massive benefits are that the community of people who do global health are just phenomenally nice people. Even within the like notoriously sharp elbowed world of academia, they're nice and they're friendly and they want to see things done well and they want to help. And it's been collaborative and like really eye-opening as to how academia can be a nice, friendly, warm place if you hit the right tribe. I think that the scope is vast, that you can pretty much be interested in anything and find a global health way of applying that. So, you know, we've got people who are doing global health PhDs in Cambridge who are proper hardcore molecular biologists. And then you've got people like me who wander around interested in sort of storytelling and how I draw pretty pictures of that to understand systems. And there's a kind of academic space for you because the definition of global health is so broad. I mean, you could go off and look at health economics if you wanted to, or epidemiology. You know, there's so much space. So I think those opportunities are vast. And I think also anaesthetics is quite a good place to start from, because we tend to be quite a broad church of people who are doing research in all sorts of funny places. You know, you could end up looking at clinical trials, or you could end up doing something, you know, like I say, looking at health economics or something. I think that increasingly there are particular hubs in the UK where you probably have a greater chance of something happening. And so you probably do need to be a little bit smart about where you situate yourself for your core and registrar training, because not everywhere will have a teaching hospital or affiliated university that will have someone that will fit you. And so there probably needs to be a bit of scoping around that in terms of where you'll be easily received and where you might get a toehold, because you need some kind of structure to sit yourself in. I hope that's getting better.
I was going to say, one way, I suppose, of meeting like-minded people, you are the outgoing president of the World Anesthesia Society. So, you know, groups like this that have mailing lists and things are one way that you can get to know like-minded people. I wonder if you'd just say a couple of things about the World Anesthesia Society and its what sorts of things it does.
Yeah, so World Anesthesia is it's been brilliant, actually. So it was set up by Mike Dobson ages ago. I actually went digging for the history of it, and there's kind of an article in Anesthesia, I think from 1984, calling for people to get together who are interested in global anesthesia. But if you dig back through the anesthesia archives, there was a working party set up to look at the problem of lower middle income countries in anesthesia, you know, decades ago. And so I think, you know, when I got involved with World Anesthesia Society, I was an SHO, and I think Ian Wilson had just given it up to Bruce McCormick, and Ian was going on to be the head of the Association of Anaesthetists, as it now is, you know, then the AGBI. And basically it was set up as a club for people interested in similar stuff. And it was based around meetings and seminars where people got to meet up in Portland Place, listen to some interesting speakers talking about stuff they were doing, and then go to the pub and hatch plans and do things. And, you know, it spawned all sorts of stuff, like, you know, Lifebox was this product of Ian Wilson and Isabeau Walker, you know, hatching these plans in the pub around the corner from Portland Place. And it was all very integrated with World Anesthesia. And just a really lovely, like, welcoming and inspirational group of people. And I think that's what its role should still be. You know, it's very informal, and it's really just a way of reminding yourself there are other people out there doing cool stuff. And occasionally things bubble up, which become an opportunity, whether that's someone saying, look, I'm organizing this trip, do you want to come? Or you go to a seminar and you hear someone talking about their project, you think that's brilliant, I'm going to get involved with that. It's been, you know, really challenged by COVID, because we can't do the face-to-face meetings, and the seminar sessions online, while they're really good for getting people to present, it gives a much better platform for our colleagues from low middle income countries to sort of talk about their lives and their work. It lacks that kind of human interaction that really gets people excited, which is often the, you know, the social stuff around the court, around the sides. But yeah, so World Anesthesia is essentially, it's the subspecialist society, like Difficult Airway Society or the OAA, if you're an obstetric anaesthetist. WA is the specialist society for anaesthetists interested in global health. We put out a publication twice a year called World Anesthesia News to give people something to read about all everything that's going on. And we try and run seminar or conferences twice a year. The upcoming one, we've now partnered our spring seminar with the Royal College because of their new global partnerships team. And so our spring seminar is coming out, is out to book now, and that's on the subject of health equity post-COVID, with some really exciting speakers, hopefully booked for that. And then we also give grants and awards to help people actually go overseas and do stuff. So we use our membership subs to help finance trips. And that's all dispersed through the International Relations Committee of the Association. So that's the place where the college and the association and us and a couple of other membership bodies come and pool their money to help people go overseas and do projects. And we fund anything from kind of like tiny little seed projects of people who just want to go to a particular place to meet a department they think they might be able to do something with, through to really big established projects with people who've been working together for years. And so that's what we still aim to do. I'm giving over the presidency to Becky Paris, who's based in Hereford. So she'll be taking over the reins over the next 6 months. But it will be continue to be very active in that front. And as soon as COVID lets us go to the pub again, it will hopefully go back to being the very warm and friendly bubble of people who kind of hatch plans and then make things happen. So yeah, it's a very friendly society and has not yet been sort of forced to be too corporate or too formal. So it's still a very, very much a collection of friends.
I can attest to that. It certainly is very friendly. I'll pop in the ending, I'll pop in the link to the website.
Oh, fantastic.
So people know where to find it if they'd like to. Tom, thanks so much for speaking to me today. It's been really brilliant to hear. Well, you've increased my knowledge of Myanmar by several 100%. and it's been great to have a look at the non-clinical context and think about global health in that perspective. So thanks very much for being here.
Brilliant. Really, really happy to talk to you. And thanks so much for having me on.
If you'd like to find out more about the World Anesthesia Society, their website is www.worldanesthesia.uk. That's www.worldanesthesia.uk. The next World Anesthesia Society event, which is a collaboration with the Royal College of Anaesthetists, is coming up on the 16th of March. Its title is Global Anaesthesia Towards Health Equity, and it's an online event with talks and discussions, and they have some really great speakers lined up. You can find details on the Royal College's website, and I believe that doctors from low and middle income countries can join free of charge. As well, on the 15th of March, so just the day before, the college is running an online version of its popular Developing World Anaesthesia course, which is a really good introduction to the practice of anaesthesia in less well-resourced environments. That's all for this episode. Bye for now.